today is the 9th of July, 2005. I'm in Mali, in West Africa, where I've come to see the biggest mud building in the world. The Great Mosque of Djenné, an astonishing sight. Driving up here yesterday, the mobile phone rang, and I heard that 7 bombs had exploded in London that morning. Hundreds were injured, scores were dead. The handiwork, probably, of Al-Qaeda. Among the stations that were bombed was the one my daughter uses to go to school. I spent a horrible couple of hours battling with lousy phone connections, finding out she was all right. You think dark things at moments like that, and I fretted about this film. Was it right to be making it? It's about the wonders of Islamic art, but was that still an appropriate subject? I knew the answer long before I arrived here and saw that. I had just spent months and months crisscrossing the Islamic world, and everywhere I'd been, I'd seen fascinating and beautiful things. Some of the most fascinating and beautiful things I had ever seen, made by fascinating, beautiful people who had never shown me anything but kindness, friendship, and hospitality. Not to have made this film would have been utterly dishonest. There's something over there I wanted to show you. We're coming at it from an unusual angle from the back, but you'll recognise it straight away when you see it. It's a beautiful example of Islamic art. Perhaps the most beautiful example of all. Rather like a typical Islamic work of art, the real story of Islam is sparkling, fascinating, complicated, and gorgeous. And the best way to tell it is not with scary interviews and politics. That's just news. The winds of time will blow all that away. The truest evidence that any civilization ever leaves behind about itself is its art. Art never lies. It didn't lie about the Greeks. It didn't lie about the Romans, and it certainly doesn't lie about Islam. Ah, the Taj. The most beautiful building in the world? Of course it is. So beautiful and so Islamic. There are various stylistic features to enjoy about the Taj that make it typically Islamic. The love affair that's going on here with simple, gleaming geometry. No other religion has ever trusted geometry as profoundly as this. This sense of perpetual decoration, of saying it with flowers. And all this sensuous calligraphy, words turned into art, quotations from the Quran, an Islamic speciality. But there's something else, something that unites all Islamic art from nation to nation across the centuries like a super glue. I'm going to give it a name. I'm going to call it the atmosphere of paradise. You can see what I mean immediately. It's that air of delicate, God-given perfection, of dreams fulfilled and divine tranquility. It's unmissable and so, so desirable. How Islam developed this addictive appetite for paradise, when, where, and why it was developed is quite a story. It's our story. Islam emerged in some of the world's hottest and least hospitable places. Its creators were desert people. Its moods were desert moods. And to get a feel for its art, I suggest we consider the desert dweller's relationship to an oasis. Islam has its own calendar. Day one of this calendar marks the departure of the Prophet Muhammad, Islam's founder, from Mecca, where he was born, and his arrival at the oasis of Medina, where he settled and built himself a very significant house. The Prophet didn't select the exact spot for his new house himself. He left the choice to his camel, which, guided by Allah, stopped at some open land owned by two orphaned brothers. The Prophet purchased this land, and on it he built his new dwelling. When asked to explain this simple choice, he said, "A man is where the saddle of his camel is." The land had some palm trees on it, which Muhammad cut down, and he marked out a typical Arabian dar, a walled courtyard made of mud bricks, much like these, except a lot bigger. It was square, 50 metres by 50 metres, and it had these humble dwellings along the edges, and the walls were about 10, 11 feet high, like these are. On the edge of the courtyard, the Prophet built some huts for his wives. Modest, mud-brick structures with palm roofs. At the centre, he dug a well. And later, when his followers complained of sitting in the exposed sun, he gave them shelter, a simple portico of palm tree columns covered with palm leaves. The first mosque. Every mosque that came afterwards is descended architecturally from this simple, rustic arrangement of the Prophet's house in Medina. And there's something else that the house in Medina bequeathed to all subsequent mosques, and that's its communal air. These Middle Eastern courtyards have so many roles. It's where the animals are tethered, it's where the washing's done, it's where food is cooked. It's where the Prophet preached to his followers and where sometimes the followers would stay overnight in the shade of the portico. And this sense of a community going about its business behind protective walls was another of the great gifts to the future of the Prophet's dwelling. The mosque began its marvellous and busy history, not as a temple or a daunting place of worship, but as a home. Originally, at prayer times, the community would turn to pray in the direction of the holy city of Jerusalem. But then, one momentous night, the angel Gabriel came to the Prophet in a dream and showed him Mecca. He actually saw the city through a miraculous gap in the vista. And from that moment, the orientation of every mosque was changed and turned to Mecca. The direction of Mecca is marked by the mihrab, a niche in the Qibla wall. Sometimes simple, sometimes gorgeous. sometimes plain, sometimes filled with the flowers of paradise. But the mihrab is always turned to Mecca.
So let's see, there's paleontology, and then archaeology, sociology. There we go, the map room.
The medieval map of the Islamic world. It's pretty accurate.
But can you see where you live on it? No. That's because in these medieval maps of the Islamic world, north and south are the other way round. North is at the bottom and south is at the top. But if I turn this upside down, it all becomes more familiar. There's Italy, Sicily, the Mediterranean. There's Spain, North Africa. And Islam began on the Arabian Peninsula here, where Muhammad was born in Mecca in around 570 AD. That's 570 years after the birth of Jesus Christ. But this brand new religion spread across the world at an astonishing speed. Within a century, the Islamic Empire stretched from Spain over here, all the way across North Africa, through Central Asia, right up to the Chinese borders. It was the most explosive expansion that any religion had ever mounted. At first, with all this conquering going on, there wasn't much time for art. But that changed when the Islamic capital was moved from Mecca here southwards, or northwards, as we'd call it, to this great city here. Damascus, the world's oldest inhabited city, they say, and one which used to be notoriously beautiful. Today, the entire city has turned to face an electronic Mecca, called to prayer by the satellite dish. But in less trashy times, Damascus worshipped better deities with more glorious consequences. It's written that Muhammad, on a trip from Mecca, got as far as the outskirts of Damascus, and then he stopped. He refused to go any further. When asked why, he explained that man should only enter paradise once, and that one time was on the day he died. Famed internationally for its luxuries and its fertility, Damascus was such a desirable oasis, so full of many precious things, that everybody wanted it. The Phoenicians were here, Hittites, Assyrians, Babylonians, Greeks, Romans, Christians, they all lent Damascus their ear. And right here, there was a pagan temple to the Aramaean god Hadad. Now that was taken over by the Romans. See the Corinthian columns there and that large chunk of pediment. That's what's left of one of the largest temples to Jupiter in the whole of the ancient world. And it looked rather like that. See here the entrance gate where the columns still are, and there in the middle, the sanctuary where the famous statue of Jupiter stood. When the Romans converted to Christianity with Constantine, when the Roman Empire became the Byzantine Empire, this became a Christian church, a basilica, in which were preserved some very precious relics, because it was said that buried here
was the head of John the Baptist. And when the Muslims conquered Damascus, around these precious remains was built this huge mosque. For nearly a century after they arrived here, Muslims shared this space with Christians. The Christians would worship at the west end here, and Muslims would worship at the east end. It was a working religious timeshare. But eventually, the caliphs, Muhammad's successors, who'd moved their capital from Mecca to Damascus, realized they needed a place of worship of their own. And so here, on the former Temple of Jupiter that had become a Christian church, they set about inventing the Islamic mosque. The land was actually purchased from the Christians who owned it by the Umayyad Caliph, Al-Walid I, for whom money was never an object. His mosque was built in a decade at stupendous expense. 7 years of taxes from the whole of Syria were spent on it before it was finished in 715. Not only is it the earliest surviving mosque, but to this day it remains amongst the most spectacular. The chief treasures of this Damascus mosque are its mosaics in twinkling glass and gold. There's been so much argument about what the golden walls are showing us. What is this fantastic architecture imagined here? Where are these rivers? Where are those trees? Some say these are perfect evocations of Damascus itself, beautified and watered. Others believe the mosaics represent the Muslim conquests, that Al-Walid I was showing the world what Islam now possessed. Personally, I just don't believe any of that. This doesn't feel at all aggressively possessive, and it doesn't look anything like Damascus. What you feel with these luxurious trees, so bounteous and green, the rippling waters, the fantastic palaces, is a sense of somewhere perfect and peaceful. Somewhere like paradise. This is what Muhammad wanted to see once and only once. Even the colours of those mosaics, that luscious green, the sumptuous gold, those are the colours described in the Quran of paradise. But look, there's no one there yet. No people, no animals. It's ready, but it's empty and waiting for us. All we have to do is lead the right life, do the right things, and follow the right God. I've seen wall-to-wall imaginings of paradise like these before in Buddhist fresco cycles. If you go to India or China, and of course the traders of Damascus were famous for such travels, you'll find painted caves filled with visions of paradise, with palaces, rivers, bridges, gold, trees. So Islam took all these ingredients, bits of the Christian basilica, pieces of the Roman temple, visions of paradise from the Buddhists, and it mixed them all together and came up with something completely unmistakable and Islamic, something the world had never seen before. Yet how clearly you sense here the basic arrangement of Muhammad's simple courtyard. A covered hall to shelter the faithful from the sun. A fountain at the centre to wash at and purify yourself. The sense of a meeting place to which everyone is invited. Having settled on this basic arrangement for its first great mosque, Islam liked it so much it stayed with it for 1,000 years and beyond. I wanted to show you this unusual structure. It's where the treasures of the mosque were kept, an early Islamic bank vault set high up on these Roman columns that don't quite fit. Now up here, look carefully, there's a sundial that was used to calculate the times of the call to prayer when every Muslim was expected to turn to Mecca. Now that's a very easy thing to say, at the call to prayer you turn to Mecca. But how exactly would somebody living in 8th century Damascus know where Mecca was? It's relatively easy here. Mecca isn't that far away. But what if you come from West Africa, from Timbuktu, or Samarkand in Central Asia, or Genghis Khan country? Well, you begin by inventing some helpful instruments like these. Astronomy, mathematics, geometry, Arabian science was far ahead of the West in all of them. And such exquisite instruments were fashioned by Islamic craftsmen to make simpler the difficult task of knowing exactly where Mecca was. Certain where 1001 Arabian Nights was written, probably here in Cairo. The atmosphere is certainly right. The streets here teem with rascals, smooth talkers and clowns. It's intoxicating, but also edgy. Religions attract conflict as well as stability. With destiny to play for, there's always room for differing opinions, and Islam is no different. The big split in Islam is between Sunni and Shiite. Someone once explained it to me as the equivalent in Christianity of the difference between Methodists and Catholics, with the Shiites as the Catholics. And it's true, Shiite art is usually more ornate and florid than Sunni. But sometimes it's the other way round. With Islamic art, you never quite know where the journey's going to finish. But the reasons for the Sunni-Shiite split are plain enough. It was a dynastic dispute, an argument over who should lead Islam. The Shiites believed only those descended directly from the Prophet himself, family members, could claim to be his successor. The Sunnis, meanwhile, insisted that caliphs should be chosen for their organizational talents, their suitability, not their bloodline. So, was it reason or emotion, the brain or the blood? This is the shrine of Hussein, the Prophet's grandson and son of Fatima, Muhammad's favorite daughter. Fatima was married to Ali, who was chosen as caliph, one of Muhammad's successors, and then assassinated. His son, Hussein, went to war against the Sunni Umayyads to right this wrong, but he too was killed and his family murdered. Thus, blood entered the equation, lots of it. And in these parts, that's not quickly forgotten. The Shiites were marginalized by the Sunni caliphs and became the party of rebels and minorities. The disaffected turned to them. They were the Robin Hoods of Islam and learned to be utterly ruthless. Fated to remain a minority in the early Islamic world, the Shiites only claimed one major territory for themselves, and that was here in Cairo when the Fatimids arrived. Fatimids took their name from Fatima, Muhammad's favourite daughter, the mother of Hussein. They too claimed descent from the Prophet, and these Fatimids built Cairo from scratch. There was nothing here when they arrived, and apparently they called their new capital Al-Kaira, the Conqueror, after the planet Mars, which was in the ascendancy when they got here. Some would say the planet Mars has been in the ascendancy around here ever since. The Fatimids were a revolutionary force in Islamic art. They changed many things. Here at the Azhar Mosque, bang in the heart of Cairo, they built a cluster of colleges devoted to the pursuit of knowledge. It was the world's first university, founded in 972. Yes, 972. The Fatimids were particularly keen on education as a way of spreading the Shiite theology and gaining extra converts in secret. It's a different route to power, and some still employ it. See these arches? Keel-shaped, they're called. Those were a Fatimid invention. Cairo is particularly good for arches. That mosque with the spiral minaret has pointed arches, superb pointed arches. They weren't an Islamic invention. The Sassanids had used them already. But Islam developed and popularized the pointed arch and then passed it westwards so that the Gothic Age could happen. Gothic owes so much to Islam. I love these spaces, these forests of columns. This is called the hippostyle type of mosque, which basically means that it has lots and lots of columns supporting a flat roof. It's a very simple way of building, descended directly from that portico in the Prophet's courtyard, where the palm trees and the thatch gave his followers somewhere to shelter from the sun. This does exactly the same. But see here, where the mihrab is, a small dome, a widening, because almost despite itself, Islam was developing a need to mark its most holy wall more grandly. It's a tendency we'll be keeping an eye on, because this need to rise up to dizzy heights becomes one of the key issues in Islamic architecture. Among the most famous of all Quranic verses is the one inscribed most often on mosque lamps. It's called the Light Verse, Surah 24:35. God is the light of heaven and earth. The similitude of his light is a niche in the wall. The glass appears as if it were a shining star.
We know this is royal. It was made for Sultan Barkuk, Egyptian ruler. We know the date, which is about 1385.
It's dated, is it?
It's toward the end of... No, we know when he ruled. That's why we know the date.
And this would hang just in front...
Either in the mosque or in the house. But they call it mosque lamp because that is the description that was given when it was produced. But it didn't mean that it was specifically used in the mosque. It was probably was used in probably homes and palaces too. And that there were chains coming from here holding this. And most of the time they had a bowl which was like us sitting on the top of the lamp. And there was always a question, how come they needed to have an ostrich-shaped glass ball sitting between the chain that connected the lamp to the ceiling. And usually, obviously, they had candle inside. Mm-hmm. The reason was that they didn't want to have animals falling into it.
I see.
So if
that's something where you collected the flies.
That's correct.
Or and, flies,
sometimes, yeah, sometimes maybe mice. They fall outside of the lamp rather than falling into it.
That's excellently practical.
Yeah.
Can you imagine this, though, with a candle inside flickering?
Thinking that this is over 700 years old.
Egypt has a special relationship with precious stones. You know those stories of Cleopatra's fabulous emerald mines? Well, they're not stories. Cleopatra really did have fabulous emerald mines. And she was an ancient Egyptian connoisseur of the sparkling gemstone, as were the Fatimids. The most precious and magical of all Fatimid treasures were actually made from the most abundant mineral on Earth. Scientists, who have their own miraculous ways of calculating these things, tell us that 12% of the Earth's crust is made of quartz. And quartz, in its clearest form, is called rock crystal. They don't mine it around here anymore, but they used to. It was as common in the deserts of Egypt as sand. Actually, it basically was sand, silicone dioxide. But the craftsmen of the Fatimids worked great magic with rock crystal. They took blocks of it, much larger than this, and carved away the insides until the walls of their rock crystal ewers and drinking glasses were as thin as paper. Crystals, like these, are of course what crystal balls used by fortune tellers used to be made from. And crystals always had this otherworldly aspect. The actual word comes from the Greek kristallos, which means ice. And the ancients believed this really was divine ice, trapped in the mountains, waiting to be revealed. And all this superstitious history, this magic air, brought extra sparkle to the rock crystal masterpieces of the Fatimids. There's something else about rock crystal, something even more pertinent than its delicate beauty and its mystical air. According to the Quran, the goblets passed around among the faithful in paradise are also carved of rock crystal. We've changed countries. We're in Iran, or Persia as it used to be known. And if you're ever assailed by doubts about Islam's contribution to the arts, if anyone ever asks you, what have the Muslims done for us? Get yourself here on a sunny day. Hunt down a taxi and head for Gombad e Kavus. Ask there for the tomb of Amr Kabus ibn Vashingir. You can't possibly miss it. When do you think that was built? 1950s? 30s? The 18th century, the 15th century, the 13th. Actually, it was finished in 1006. It's 1,000 years old. When this was built, William the Conqueror hadn't even been born. The chief religion around here, before the coming of Islam, was Zoroastrianism. It's still the oldest surviving faith in the world. The Zoroastrians built these tall towers for their dead, on which vultures would swoop and pick clean the corpse's bones. It's a highly efficient avian hygiene. And these Zoroastrian death towers influenced the look and the mood of some extremely unlikely Islamic architecture that's dotted all along the Caspian coast. This spectacular and unlikely tomb was built by a formidable local Renaissance man, Amir Kabus ibn Vashimgir, poet, scholar, calligrapher, astrologer, chess player, and ruthless regional warlord. Ibn Vashimgir ruled Gombad for 40 years. And when he began to suspect that his time might be up, he built this great mausoleum for himself here on the edge of the Turkoman steppe. It was built to be indestructible. It's 170 feet tall, and there's another 35 feet hidden from sight underground in the foundations. It's a masterpiece of unexpected minimalism. So sparse. Those razor-sharp edges, flanges they're called, go all the way around the building. They're made from desert bricks. And they cut the shadows up into thin stripes and then spend the whole day rearranging them. That's all that goes on here, but it's enough. And I like that cheeky conical cap that tops it off so perfectly. Ibn Vashimgir was assassinated 6 years after his great tower was finished. His enemies tied him up in the snow at nearby Gorgon and watched him freeze to death. But he was buried as he wanted to be, his body suspended from the tower roof in a see-through coffin made of rock crystal. There's a tiny window up there, and every time the sun rose, a shaft of light would penetrate the darkness of the tower and illuminate Ibn Vashimgir's crystal coffin. I'm not sure I can think of a more exciting way to die. I'm still in Iran, where I've come to the tomb of the Ayatollah Khomeini to gather my thoughts and set myself some priorities. If you can't gather your thoughts here, where can you gather them? This film has a simple proposition: that Islam has given the world some of its most beautiful things. We tend these days to forget that. We tend to let transient stuff, like politics, elbow out the ancient truths. So I wanted to read some poetry in here. British soldiers used to recite this to themselves in the First World War as they marched to their deaths on the Western Front. And our grandparents used to know large chunks of this by heart. It's by the 11th century Persian poet Omar Khayyam, and it captures so perfectly the fragility of Khayyam's times, indeed, of everyone's times. Strange is it not that of the myriads who, before us passed the door of darkness through, not one writ to tell us of the road which to discover we must travel to. Yesterday this day's madness did prepare, tomorrow's silence, triumph or despair. Drink, for you know not whence you came, nor why. Drink, for you know not why you go, nor where. Life is short. Sultans, presidents and ayatollahs come and go. But there's a beauty out there that can always be relied upon. A bigger beauty that Islamic art wants always to reflect and match. This film is about that quest. The trouble is that, like so many things in Islam, this elusive beauty keeps changing. The Islamic Empire was packed with far too many different types of international creative ever to arrive at a consensus. Isfahan, on the hot edges of the Persian desert, was a particularly busy trading city, which everyone tried to grab. For 200 years, it was controlled by the Seljuks. They lost it to the Mongols. Then the Timurids took over. Finally, Isfahan fell to the Safavids, who ruled here in the 16th century, and whose artistic achievements were surprisingly frisky. The Safavids built half a dozen of these ambitious and charming bridges across the Zayandeh River. These high walls protected the incoming camel caravans from sandstorms and vicious desert crosswinds. The Safavid bridges had two levels. Underneath the camel level, there's a chain of tea rooms stretching across the river where visitors and locals alike have spent 500 years sheltering from the heat, smoking hookahs, quoting Omar Khayyam, sipping tea and keeping their heads down. It's usefully out of sight down here. The tea rooms have special compartments for rent where all sorts of mildly illicit things go on. I've just seen a chap and his girlfriend ensconced in one, and she was puffing away merrily at her hookah, which, in modern Iran, is rather naughty of her. In Isfahan, since the time of the Safavids, a certain amount of Islamic rule-breaking has always gone on, and not just in the tea rooms. The Safavids were the first Shiite rulers of Persia, and their taste in art had about it a transgressive air, a Shiite ornateness. The Shahs of the Safavids were, you feel, instinctive pleasure seekers, free thinkers, and rule breakers. Dancing girls, a pair of them. Who would have thought it? You find them hidden around various corners of Isfahan, because the Safavids tore up the old Islamic rule book and wrote themselves a new one. Having made Isfahan their capital, they built it quickly into the grandest city in Persia. This Safavid square out here, Imam Square, is the second largest square in the world. Only Tiananmen Square in Beijing is bigger than this. And the entire perimeter is ringed with great architecture. Two mosques, a palace, and over there, the entrance to the infamous Isfahan Bazaar, where only a brave man should ever venture. This gigantic up on that balcony and watch military parades passing by. And for 400 years, the square was also used as a polo pitch, and these were the two goalposts. A opposite his balcony, Shah Abbas constructed a gorgeous mosque for the ladies of his harem. You enter it through a secret passage that winds you round and round till you point in the right direction and face Mecca. Our cameraman, Simon, has been complaining about coming into these gorgeous Persian spaces. He says it's too dark in here. And it's true. The camera can never see what I can see. And it can never fall in love with Persian darkness in the way the human eye can and must. Don't ask me where anything ends in here or anything begins. I just can't tell you. The tile work doesn't really favour solidity. It rises up, 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 and when it gets to the dome, it becomes extra miraculous. Can you see how the lozenges get smaller and smaller and create a tiled whirlwind that sucks you up? The man who designed and calculated this domical effect had phenomenal hand-to-eye coordination and an extreme sense of geometry. Modern Iran, where a woman cannot show her hair or her forearms, where the morality police can forcibly remove your nail varnish and submit you to a virginity test, has had to reach a difficult accommodation with the art of the Safavids. These treasures of Isfahan attract too many moneyed visitors to be locked away. But as you wander amongst them, I swear you can sometimes hear an angry Ayatollah going tut, tut, tut. The most perfectly preserved of the Safavid pleasure gardens is the Chehal Sotun Palace. It's gorgeous, it twinkles, it's a man-made paradise with birds, flowers, and a sense of enclosure. This is where the Safavid Shahs welcomed foreign visitors and set out to impress them. The glass in the portico was imported expensively from Venice, and it attempts many Islamic tricks with reflections. But it's in here, in the great hall of the Safavids, that the most surprising spectacle awaits you. A monumental Islamic fresco cycle. Now that is a turn-up. The Safavids waging battles. The Safavids throwing ostentatious banquets. Lounging around, listening to music, drinking wine. It's the Persian miniature writ huge and given monumental ambition.
All the colors you see here is natural color. That's why, because they use natural colors, it stayed. It didn't fade away.
Phenomenal colors, phenomenal.
What you see in front of you here is probably one of the finest 16th century Safavid carpet in the world. The inscription that you see around it is a Persian poetry, which relates to the design of the carpet. It talks about flowers, it talks about birds, it talks about the beauty of nature.
Would it be true to say that this is an evocation of paradise in the Quranic sense? That, I mean, people have said almost all carpets have as an ambition this need to convey some of the sensations of paradise, the pleasures of paradise, the mood of paradise.
Yes, you could say that. You could say that.
I'm in Uzbekistan, deep in Central Asia, dodging the trucks. It's hairy, but I like it because I know what lies at the end of the journey. An amusing tale is told about the arrival of the Arabs in Samarkand. I find it amusing, anyway. There were three Arab missionaries who stopped here and decided to let Allah decide their fate by cutting up and boiling a large sheep. The first missionary reaches into the pot and he pulls out the sheep's heart, and he knows that he must return to Mecca, the heart of Islam. The second missionary, he reaches in and pulls out the sheep's head, and he knows he has to stay here in Samarkand. The third missionary, he reaches in and he pulls out the sheep's arse, and he knows that he must leave immediately for Baghdad, which he does. But me, I'm staying here, Samarkand. Now there's a name to conjure with. The mirror of the world, they called it, the pearl of the East, the jewel of Islam. But then they also call it the city of famous shadows, and that's because it's haunted by so many ghosts. Samarkand's an oasis on the edge of the Kizil Qum Desert. The trouble with being an oasis is that everybody wants your water and they all know where you are. This program's too short for me to list all the conquerors and warriors and nomadic cutthroats who'd loomed out of the desert to take Samarkand. Alexander the Great, Attila the Hun, Genghis Khan, they've all had it. Scythians, Sogdians, White Huns, Black Huns, Arabs, Ghaznavids, Mongols, Bolsheviks. This was everyone's favourite oasis, but only Tamerlane held on to Samarkand for long enough to transform it. Tamerlane was a Mongol who'd been Turkicized and converted to Islam. He claimed some sort of descent from Genghis Khan, but you'd expect that. Around here, all the ruthless warrior conquerors claimed descent from the great Khan. His real name was Timur, common name, which means iron. And Tamerlane is an English corruption of Timur the Lame. He had a disfigured leg from an old archery wound. Tamerlane was a genius at his trade, the ruthless and conscience-free conquest of anywhere he could reach. He personally conquered an empire that stretched from Moscow to Delhi, from modern Turkey to the outer edges of Russia. But when it came to choosing a capital, Tamerlane picked somewhere just around the corner from where he was born. Samarkand, this fabulous crossroads on the Silk Route, which Timur the Lame transformed into this architectural gem in the desert. Timur the Lame is one of the few mortals who's given his name to a style of architecture. And this Timurid architecture is one of the glories of Islam. The City of Domes is another of Samarkand's names. They glitter here on every horizon and give Samarkand a permanent shimmer, as if the mirage can never settle. Domes have always had an obvious relationship with the heavens. People used to think of the sky itself as a giant dome covering the earth. And Timurid architecture makes this connection entirely explicit. The buildings and lower halves are fashioned out of these desert bricks, so brown and earthy like the ground around here. And then rising above them are these celestial domes, usually coloured an evocative turquoise. Timurids specialised in this blue. Their architecture is excellently colour-coded for instant legibility.
The domes are blue, the buildings are brown, the message on the walls could hardly be bigger or clearer or more insistent. Out here in the desert, on the edges of the empire, in the middle of nowhere, you need to spell it out. The word minaret is derived from the Arabic word minara, which means lighthouse.
Originally, these Timurid minarets were intended to be literally lighthouses in the desert. You have to imagine them rising like steeples in this hot and flat land, visible from all angles. And thirsty camel traders trudging along the Silk Route, seeing one of these in the distance and knowing that here they would find water and hope and God.
Allah, 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 it says on this one. Muhammad, Muhammad, Muhammad. It's a brilliant piece of religious advertising, perfectly positioned in the desert to bring in the client.
So the dusty Silk Road trader is lured to this gorgeous oasis by the lighthouses. The domes tempt him closer, and he finds himself in here. A perfect garden in which a million flowers seem to be blossoming at once. So colourful, so intense. A paradise in the desert, created artificially with the slow flicker of Timurid tile work. Can you hear the water tinkling? Can you feel the shade beckoning? Who wouldn't choose a religion that promises this? I was looking forward to coming here. Shah Izindar, reputed to be Samarkand's most moving architectural site. It's a Timurid necropolis, a street of the dead in which Tamerlane buried his female relations. They say the earliest examples of Timurid architecture are found in here. Or at least, they used to be. Because look what they're doing to them. This is a UNESCO site, an official world treasure. But in Uzbekistan today, not nearly enough respect is shown for the great Islamic art of the past. As far as I can see, Shah Izindar is being vandalized. This isn't restoration, it's ruination. They're determined to complete this by Uzbekistan's Independence Day, which is coming up. This is their idea of working quickly to finish the job. It's like a construction site at a very ugly shopping centre. Look at this brickwork. Oh, look what they've done to the tiles. There are men up there hacking away at irreplaceable 15th century Timurid domes with 4-inch chisels and 10-pound mallets, and occasionally leaving precious fragments of original tilework behind. If you like buildings and you like Timurid architecture, which everyone in their right minds should, because it's one of the most inventive and unmistakable architectural traditions in our civilization, then don't come here. You'll just want to cry.
Istanbul is being summoned. First one voice, then three, then 100. So there's no getting away from it.
And in the first few centuries of Islam, the call was made from wherever was handy. An open window, a parapet, a balcony. So the minaret is a relatively late addition to Islamic architecture. And today, the loudspeaker has done away with any real need for it. But the minaret remains such a key ingredient of the mosque's identity that you can't really see anyone phasing them out. Istanbul minarets are extra thin, super pointy, like sharpened pencils. But it's not really this quiver of pointy minarets that defines the Islamic contribution to this relentlessly exciting city. The shape that best captures the spirit of Istanbul is, of course, the dome. Nothing in architecture is quite as awe-inspiring as an impossibly lofty dome. Defying gravity, floating miraculously. And Istanbul is packed with them. The greatest ensemble of extra-large domes in existence. Every one of them trying to be the biggest. In the centre of Istanbul, at the heart of the city, there is this great standoff between two macho domes, glaring across at each other like a pair of heavyweight boxers at a weigh-in. The sense of confrontation here is so obvious, it's almost amusing. In the red corner, we have Hagia Sophia, a Christian church originally, built in the 6th century, and with its height, its ambition, the conquest here of physics, this is, without a shadow of doubt, one of the four or five most significant buildings ever erected. To have achieved this in the 6th century defies belief. But then, in the other corner, you have the Blue Mosque, built 1,000 years later by the Ottoman Sultan Ahmed I, but determined, you sense, to out-dome Hagia Sophia, to match the ancient Christians, and indeed, to beat them.
Ah yes, the Ottomans. You were wondering when we'd get to them, weren't you? Even the most chronic sufferer from dynasty fatigue will always stir at the sound of the Ottomans. These conquerors of Istanbul were such showy showmen.
When I was 18 or so, studying art history, I came here on an official student trip. And in front of this thing, the famous Topkapi dagger, I suffered an attack of Stendhal syndrome. It's a proper illness, an actual physical reaction, diagnosed by doctors. You feel dizzy, disorientated. Some people actually faint and fall over, literally knocked out by the power of art.
In my experience, Islamic art encourages this heavyweight dizziness more fiercely than any other artistic tradition. And the strong room of the Topkapi Palace, where the treasures of the Ottomans are kept, is a dangerous place for the Stendhal sufferer. This is the Tugra, the official signature of the grandest of the Ottoman sultans, Suleiman the Magnificent. There's a world within a world in there, a cosmos within a cosmos, a garden within a garden. Not bad, eh, for a king's autograph.
They say Istanbul is built on seven hills. But that wasn't enough for the Ottomans, so they added these other ones. It took 100 years for an architectural hero to emerge in Istanbul, capable of taking on the early Christians at dome building and beating them. His name was Minar Sinan. They say he was born in 1493 in Christian Armenia, taken forcibly as a slave, converted to Islam, which he then embraced so keenly. Allah repaid Sinan's faith in him by letting him live to be 100. He worked for 3 Ottoman sultans and was staggeringly productive. He built at least 100 mosques in Istanbul, and around 30 of them are still standing. This is the mightiest of Sinan's Istanbul mosques. Started in 1550 on the excited orders of Suleiman the Magnificent, the Suleimani Mosque was finished in just 7 years. It's more of a landscape feature than a building, a man-made cluster of mini mountains rising, rising, rising to that Everest in the middle. It isn't just the size of this mosque that fills you with awe, it's the mood too. It makes you feel all floaty, as if your heart's been pumped up with helium. It's a narcotic experience. You're high on the art of the Ottomans. Their domes are very different from European domes. St. Paul's in London or St. Peter's in Rome go like that. They're melon-shaped. But these Ottoman domes are much flatter. They're like the top of a flying saucer. They make the whole space enclose you and seem somehow circular, as if the entire building is one gigantic dome. To pay for its upkeep, the Great Mosque was given the income of 217 of Suleiman's villages and a couple of his islands. And Suleiman also had Sinan build a selection of funding enterprises around the corner, including a Turkish bath, in which Suleiman had his own cubicle, and so did Sinan. The Ottomans built 150 or so Turkish baths. So many, they created a city-wide water shortage. Cleanliness was a fetish so potent in Ottoman Istanbul that it had a special school of poetry devoted to it. I'm afraid my Turkish isn't up to translating it for you. Instead, a few words from Philip Larkin seem appropriate. If I were called in to construct a religion, I should make use of water. Going to church would entail affording to dry different clothes. My liturgy would employ images of sousing, a furious, devout drench. And I should raise in the east a glass of water where any angled light would congregate endlessly. Left or right? I can never be sure. I think it's the right. Very easy to get lost in these streets. I'm looking for the Rustan Pasha Mosque, built in honour of Suleiman the Magnificent's longest-lasting Grand Vizier, Rustan Pasha. And Sinan, who designed it, had to fit it in to this awkward and cramped
city's face. And these shops underneath, they were built specially to provide income for the mosque, which was balanced on top of them. And they still pay taxes to sustain it. It's up on a platform above the city. And as you can see, the outside of it is plastered with an amazing sequence of Isnik tiles. But that is only a taster of what lies within, because the Rustan Pasha Mosque probably features the finest collection of Islamic tiles in the world. What a sight. Sinan went slightly mad in here. It's an experiment with tiles that he never repeated anywhere else. They're everywhere. Mihrab tiles, back tiles, galleries tiles, dome tiles. Wall to wall is Nick tiling. And every single piece in here, every square inch of this, is the finest quality Isnik. It's a limited range of colours, classic Isnik. Lots of blue, of course, which everyone loves. But you know the colour that I like most? The colour that's everywhere in here. It's that. Sort of tomato-coloured, brown-red. It's called Anatolian Bowl. And nobody to this day knows exactly where they found it or how they did this with it. If you run your finger over it, it's lumpy. When you put it in the kiln, it rose, and it gives it an extra sparkle. To this very day, they haven't been able to reproduce that exact colour. They've tried. Everyone's tried. But the Anatolian bowl of the Isniks is beyond them. You'll recognise this shape here. It's a cliché of Isnik tile work. The Turkish tulip. They were actually discovered not far from here, in the hills above Anatolia. And from Turkey, the tulip arrived in Europe, where it caused mayhem, became so popular. But the Turks themselves reclaimed their own tulip rather belatedly. It didn't appear in Isnik tile work until well into the Ottoman period. But once it had appeared there, it made up for it, certainly, as it began appearing everywhere. Absolutely everywhere. There's a chance, a very vague chance, that you don't know what Isnik tiles are. So I've mounted an arduous expedition from Istanbul to find out.
I came to find out more about Isnik tiles.
Yes.
How they're made. You are one of the few craftsmen who still use the old techniques.
Yes.
Your workshop is here, is it, at the back? We have a look.
This color is important in Isnik because the metal oxide is.
Metal oxides?
Yes. Copper.
Copper oxide.
Copper.
Green,
Green. Green and the other copper is turquoise.
Turquoise is copper. So the Isnik tiles, when they use turquoise, it's from copper oxide.
Copper, yes.
So what about this Anatolian bowl, the red color, the difficult
red,
color?
Red is important. I use the Isnik clay.
Isnik clay, this is the... This is the famous Isnik color.
Yes.
Peter, you dig clay yourself here? Do you go?
Yes.
You find the place?
I found. Yes.
So you have a secret secret
yes,
place?
Yes, secret.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes, secret.
People say that it's very, very, very difficult now to get the same color.
Yes.
Why? Same clay.
Because they lost.
Oh, they lose.
50% lost the. Fifth color. Yes.
So when you actually put it in the kiln to bake it, 50% of it gets lost.
Yes.
I see.
Yes.
So it's not very efficient. So they don't use it now.
Yes.
But you use it.
Yes. I
excellent.
I use.
It's a beautiful color. Look, maybe we can show people there. Look. Tomato red.
Yes.
Beautiful. Some think Islam's an inflexible religion, fixed, unsmiling, doctrinaire. And in some places, these days, it is. But the story told by its art, the true story of Islam, is one of extreme nimbleness and constant change. When it crossed the Sahara and plunged into the deserts of West Africa, when it got to here, Mali, look how superbly it adapted to local conditions. All the larger mosques around here are exactly a day's journey apart. They're like mystic petrol stations, spaced carefully along the trade routes. This is the biggest of them, the Great Mosque of Djenneh. It looks ancient, doesn't it? Venerable. But actually, it was built in 1907. This is a 20th century building. Djenneh is the oldest known city in the whole of the sub-Sahara. It's even older than Timbuktu, its sister city further up the Niger. Djenneh, they tell us, was settled in the 3rd century BC, but Islam only reached here in the 14th century, brought by the Arab traders who'd crossed the Sahara and decided, quite understandably, not to return. Legend has it that the first king of Djenneh who converted to Islam knocked down his palace to build a mosque instead. Not this actual building, an earlier one on the same site, which survived here for 500 years before crumbling back into desert dust. This particular version of it was built when the French were here, and it's the largest mud structure in the world. In all the old books about it, you'll read that the French were responsible for its planning and its construction. But that's a typical piece of colonial rewriting. It's simply not true. The latest research agrees that from the baked and holy ground it stands on to those dinky tips of its minarets, this is an entirely African construction. If French engineers had measured out this courtyard, they'd surely not have come up with the creative parallelogram followed by this ground plan. This is not a shape that exists in European geometry. Fantastical, looming, unlikely, no European imagination could ever have come up with this. Its outlines, its colours, its sheer inventiveness
are so obviously from around here. The Great Mosque of Djenne is a giant tribute to an unmistakably local look. It's made entirely from mud bricks. This entrance to the courtyard is said to look like a giant mask. You go in through the mouth and see those minarets with the ostrich eggs spiked into the top. They're said to symbolize purity and fertility. And they also protect the tips of the towers at their most vulnerable point against the enemy which all these mosques of Mali most fear, rain. Thus, the Great Mosque of Djenne combines the needs of Islam with more ancient and endemic needs of the local population. The inside is cool and dark in the preferred Djenne manner. Star-shaped holes in the roof create a charming internal sky. We had to use a local cameraman to get our shots of the inside. Westerners aren't allowed in anymore. In 1996, a French fashion magazine filled the mosque with half-naked models showing off some latest designs. I suppose I'd better not name that disgraceful magazine, but it's habitually and crudely interested in the latest vogues. Every village in the area has a mini mosque featuring fabulous variations on the Djenne style. They're all different, of course, but they share a common enemy, water. Every time the rains come, once a year, huge slabs of exciting mosque are washed away. But instead of complaining about it or bemoaning their lot, the people around here see it as an annual opportunity to come together and celebrate and renew. Every spring, Djenne throws a replastering party when everyone gets together to make new mud and splatter it about. And in this village too, everyone joins in annually for this splendid replastering of their mosque. It's a giant mud beano and looks fun. But it also signals an interestingly different architectural attitude. A trust, a glorious trust in incompletion. None of the mosques around here is ever considered truly finished. All of them are ongoing projects, living buildings. And because every year they're replastered from scratch, every year is seen as a new beginning, a fresh start. And that is an excellent architectural approach. I love the mud beauty of Mali. It's such a pared-down form of Islam and shows so clearly how adept Islam was at adapting to different terrains as it poured across the world, gathering up huge armfuls of new international converts. So I love the mud mosques, but I wouldn't call them representative. Not in the way this is representative. We've seen so much money, haven't we, on our journey around the Islamic world. The Ottomans of Turkey, the Timurids of Samarkand. These were some of the richest rulers the world has had. But even the unimaginable wealth of the Ottomans or the Timurids would have seemed like small change to the most lavish of all the Islamic super dynasties. the Mughals of India.
The Mughals ruled India for three centuries after the first of them, a minor Timurid princeling called Babur, managed to conquer Delhi in 1526 and found himself in possession of an enormous heap of riches.
Babur has left behind a coruscating diary in which he records his first impressions of India.
It's spectacularly rude. "The people are not handsome," he complained. "They have no skill in architecture. No good horses, no good meat, no grapes or muskmelons, no good food or bread, no baths or colleges, no candles, no torches, not a candlestick." "Yes, but they did have diamonds as big as chicken eggs. Gold, emeralds, rubies. And that was enough to persuade the Mughals to put up with the heat and the dust and the lack of musk melons and to make India theirs." And the Mughal dissatisfaction with what they found here became an unexpectedly productive force. In the absence of an actual earthly paradise, they set about constructing one for themselves out of art and architecture. The Taj Mahal is always said to be a monument to love. The tale is endlessly repeated of how Babur's heartbroken descendant, Shah Jahan, built the Taj as a tomb for his beloved wife, Mumtaz Mahal, who died giving birth to their 14th child.
You know that famous photo of Princess Diana sitting up here on her own with no Charles beside her, looking so lonely? What made it particularly poignant is this famous story that's told of Shah Jahan's momentous royal love for Mumtaz Mahal. Unfortunately, the latest thinking on the subject is that Shah Jahan actually built the Taj for himself as his mausoleum. It's a much less romantic tale, but much more likely. When you come here to Agra and witness this sort of splendour, the Mughals displaying their inordinate wealth, there's a tendency to see it as nothing more meaningful than the scattering of rupees. Very tasteful, but still loads of money sort of behaviour. But underpinning the Mughals' spending lust was a set of specific Islamic ambitions that aren't commented upon enough or noticed enough.
Professor Khalidi, you very kindly brought out a few of your possessions. This is only a tiny smattering of what you have in your collection.
Can I just make a small correction before I go further? You called these objects on the table my possession. Nothing belongs to anybody. At the end of the day, everything is created by Almighty and it belongs to Him.
Well, I would very much like to be the temporary custodian of this.
There is a beautiful story about this box. It's made out of 93 floorless emeralds.
Yeah, the Indian emeralds.
Indian emeralds. So that's extremely, extremely rare and probably belonged to Shah Jahan. It's of his period. Mm. So they didn't make this sort of thing just for anybody. So it's probably a royal piece.
So the creator of the Taj Mahal,
yes,
cared about everything that he created. He must have been one of the greatest patrons there's ever been anywhere.
No, there were a few. I mean, he was definitely one of the greatest patrons.
This would have been used as a little jewel box, would it? Or
probably a box to put jewellery or stones or emeralds, but it was definitely a part of the court belonging.
The Quran is many things. An instruction book, a history, a guide to life. But it's also an architectural manual. Anyone who reads it properly, which architectural historians seem bafflingly unwilling to do, must be struck by the similarities between the descriptions of paradise given in the Quran and the gorgeous worlds constructed for themselves by the Mughals.
Surah 55 details the pleasures of paradise. There will be two gardens, dark green in colour from plentiful watering. In them will be springs pouring forth water in continuous abundance, and fruits and dates and pomegranates. They will recline on carpets whose inner linings will be of rich brocade, like rubies and coral. Then which of the favours of your Lord will ye deny?
The gorgeous world of the Mughals isn't just a display of spending. It's never godless or merely greedy. Fountain for fountain, palace for palace, garden for garden, all of it is an attempt to imagine the Islamic paradise and an effort to fulfill the Islamic obligation to build that paradise on earth. You must have noticed that you never see ugliness in Islamic art, or neurosis, or personal problems, or any of that dark stuff that so obsesses Western artists. Islamic art always, always tries to look as beautiful as it can. Why? Because it recognises that the problems of the artist are just storms in a teacup, utterly irrelevant in the wider scheme of things. In the end, all that matters is the beauty of God, and the artist's task is always to reflect that beauty. To do otherwise, to fret about yourself, to go all dark and miserable in your art, is to waste your artistic time.
A double bill of our new comedy, Second Time Around, starting next with Ryan and Jackson discovering how fickle the press can be.